I think unfortunately, boys become perfect victims to perpetrators because they know that no one's going to believe us because we're
Yeah.
boys. And two, they know we're not going to tell because of the stigma attached to it. And that's something that a psychologist who interviewed, a clergy member from the church found that to be true. The clergy member was like, I never targeted boys because I was gay. It was because I knew I could get away with it.
You're listening to Alchemical Voices, a podcast exploring the lives of BIPOC, transracial adoptees, and survivors of complex trauma. Hi, I'm Jaslyn, your host, a nurse, and trauma release practitioner, curiously observing the human experience. As a Black woman and survivor of human trafficking, I've encountered many, many hardships. On the road to recovery, I discovered that storytelling unites us at heart and is where we find healing, inspiration, and encouragement. In each episode, you'll hear stories from courageous souls, and we will touch on subjects such as identity confusion, the impacts of racism, complex trauma, transracial adoption, and much more. How do we rise amid trials and tribulations? How do we invite softness into our lives? We touch on these and many other questions, so tune in to experience transformative storytelling and let's heal together. Okay, welcome, welcome, welcome everyone to another episode of the Alchemical Voices podcast. Today, David Weeks has joined me in the studio, and when I read David's story, my heart and stomach just went into a knot. This story is so heart-wrenching and touching, but it's also a story of empowerment and beauty. And I can't wait for you all to listen to it and to learn from this episode. David, welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
And thank you so much for having me. I always view it as a gift to share my story and a privilege, because I know not everyone has the ability or safety to do so. And so thank you so much for holding space for me and other survivors to come forward and share our stories.
You're so, so welcome. So, David, your story is quite a, I have no word for it, but where would you like to start? Would you like to just tell people what you're doing right now, what's happening in your life and who you are, what you do, and then like dive into your background or?
Sure. Yeah. My name is David Weeks, and I am a survivor of child sex trafficking, human torture, and I turned activist trying to help others find the tunnel at the end of the very long tunnel that we all go through. And when I first started sharing my story, it was so cathartic and being able to reclaim my voice, but also seeing how something so negative was turning into a light, really, I guess it fueled me for sharing my story. And a motivator that I've always had was, hearing listeners' survivor stories has always been very validating and impactful to me in the early days of my healing. And I know for me, there wasn't a lot of male survivors coming forward. And I know that from personal experience, lived experience, and from friends, a lot of men face abuse and trauma too. And I think because of the indoctrination that we get as young boys that, boys don't cry and, to be masculine at all costs, to not show your emotion, that if you do, somehow you're weak. And I think that really prevents a lot of survivors coming forward because they don't want to be seen as less than a man. And they feel like they have to be the provider. They have to be the independent one. They have to be the one with all the answers. And because of that, it impacts the relationships that they have with people. It impacts the relationship with themselves. And I think it's really time for male survivors to really come out of the shadows and speak on their experiences. So that is a huge part of why I also tell my story.
Beautiful. I think that's a beautiful mission. And what came to me was you have the potential to be a great role model for men,
Thank you.
because of the societal conditioning, as you all the things that you mentioned. I think many would just rather stay in the dark, but because you are out here shining your light, stepping forth with your story, you're going to be an inspiration for men and young boys to come out and speak their truth. So I want to thank you
Thank
for
you.
being that light for men.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And before I go into my story, I always say, like, if you can relate to any of this, I'm so sorry. No one should ever have to relate to this, but if you do, I see you, I hear you, and I love you so much. Those were words I needed to hear for a very, very long time. And so I always like to give it to someone who needs to hear it, because a lot of people don't feel loved or seen or heard after experiencing trauma.
Yeah, I resonate with that.
And so for me, the story for me really started when I was a young boy at the age of 4. And the first memory I have is very impactful to me, because it set up the stage, I think, for a lot of other things, and reaffirmed the belief that I gathered that something's wrong with me. And I remember, for whatever reason, I start crying in my father's car, and we're leaving the neighborhood, and he turns around and he hands me back to my mother, saying, "I can't handle him anymore." And just like, "What do you mean? Like, why can't my father handle me anymore?" And just I would went and sit on the couch we had in the living room, having my warm strawberry milk, which I always had to have as a kid, and just hearing my mom and grandma in the living room having this intense conversation. And even though I don't know what they were saying, I know something about me. And so I knew not to make any noise, not to just really stay silent. And I think a lot of the abuse I survived by staying silent and not showing any needs, because anytime I showed a need or set a boundary, it was really met with resentment of how dare you, if you're so ungrateful. And I think I really took that personally and really became a people pleaser, and would overachieve to make my parents look good, because if my parents looked good, then I would be happy and I would be loved, even if it was just, breadcrumbs of love. I think when you're abused for so long, breadcrumbs of love can really feel like the whole loaf. And that's why neglect is so impactful, because we've never experienced anything more than what we were given. And we don't have a schema for anything else. And so we will enter relationships in adulthood where we receive the bare minimum, or sometimes less than the bare minimum, and continue that cycle of neglect. Many people don't know that they're neglected, because they will say, "Well, my mom or father provided a house over my head and gave me food and whatnot." And I'm like, that is as much as an orphanage would do for you. Like, that is quite literally the bare minimum of being a parent. And so I very much became a lot of parts to a lot of different people, and got very good at shape shifting. And when I came out of childhood, I really didn't have a sense of self. My sense of self was so enmeshed with my parents, because what my parents needed, I needed. And when my mom was having a bad day, I was having a bad day, and vice versa. And so, it just wasn't safe to self-individualize. And for so like that's really the where it all started when I was around 4 years old. And my I mentioned that's really impactful because we are attachment seeking creatures, and the first 3 years, 4 years of someone's life is crucial in setting attachment. And my father ended up leaving my mother and left me and my sister behind. And it's something that I don't know if I'll ever be able to forgive him doing that, even though I understand why he did that. Because my mom was so narcissistic and abusive. We were just small children, and I was this 4-year-old having seeing my father around every day to, not getting that FaceTime anymore. So it's like, where did dad go? Where did that primary caregiver go? And I think that's really why I really formed an anxious avoidant attachment style, just really of that chaoticness of childhood. And it really allowed a monster to really enter my life, which is my stepfather. And I don't really remember much after the age of four, but I remember my mother started seeing the next door neighbor, because the next door neighbor had my soon-to-be stepsister, and she was around the same age as my sister. And I never really connected with my stepfather. Even when I was a kid, I always felt this bad energy that something's not right. This person's not safe. And I think people, when we say, we have good vibes, we're really picking up on the chemical cue someone is giving off. And I think my body really just picked up on that and was like, danger, danger, danger. This person is not safe. And he's never once told me I love you, my childhood. And there was a time where like he was nice to me. I think it was really to win my mom over, to be like, look, I'm nice to your children, but like that never really lasted. And as I got older, that was really met with replaced with a lot of sadism and just like maliciousness. And my father, my stepfather, never grew up with a mother. His mother unfortunately passed away when he was a young boy. And so I think him seeing another young boy having a mother made him very envious of the relationship I had with my mother, because there was a time we were really close, and my mom had emotional incest with me, where my stepfather would go on deployment, and my mom really unraveled not having, another a male in the house. And I think she really needed to be in a relationship to soothe herself, because she never learned how to self-regulate, because my mom was also abused as a kid. And so like every part of my family was abused. Like my grandma, my father's side, my biological father's side was abused. My mother was abused, my grandmother was abused on my mom's side, and so was my grandfather. And so there's just really intergenerational cycles that have gone on. And I think my mom really never learned what love and safety is in the same breath. And she really much learned that fear and control are very good and effective ways of getting people to stay. And so my stepfather left for deployment, and my mom very much attached to me. And I was around probably like five. And we would go on these dinner dates, and my sisters wouldn't go on them, and we would I felt like she was parading me around like a boyfriend. As I got older, I feel like I'm her boyfriend. Like, she would cuddle me at night, and there were many times where it just felt really uncomfortable, and it felt like, I couldn't push her off, and I just felt really trapped. And I think that, grooming, that emotional incest really set the stage for me to be groomed later on in life as a child, because I was already exposed to it. And that there's something comes with that, the huge specialness. And I was really sick growing up as a kid. And I'm pretty sure that's from all the abuse I was receiving, but I had a really bad epilepsy, and my longest seizure was 7 minutes. And for people who don't know, like, seizures usually last like 30 seconds, maybe a minute. And so I had to go to the hospital. I was having started experiencing seizures and like early kindergarten. And I remember getting all the EEGs done, all of the testing done, having to shave my head. I've had one grand mal seizure where I went to use the bathroom and I reached for the toilet paper, and the next thing I know, I wake up rolling on the living room floor, not knowing what is happening. And so I think my nervous system was really just so overwhelmed by a lot of things. And so I was getting all the specialness, all the special treatment that my sisters weren't getting. And I think my sisters really resented me for that. They're like, why doesn't my mom love me the same way, they love David? And it really pushed a wedge between us growing up. Like, me and my sisters were never close in the slightest, even though I really much looked up to my older sister. I thought she was, my hero for a very long time. She was my protector. And as I got older, that hero started turning very much into a villain. And I would say she's a lot worse than my mom. And unfortunately, we're not in communication. My sister, I think, learned my mom's skills and almost perfected it as a way, as being very coercive, very strategically manipulating people. And that really two faces to everyone. And that's a lot of the things was in public. My mom was this caring, charismatic, confident, look at me, I love my children. And then behind closed doors, she was rageful, neglectful. She would often say, you need me more than I need you, or like, no one loves you, or like, you're not special, get off your high horse. And I've always like kind of been really intuitive to my emotions. Like, I've always been an empath. And like, when my mom would, on the dinner table, my mom would excuse herself, and this is back when my stepfather was in deployment, she would excuse herself to the bathroom. And I know that was really key for, I'm going to go to my bedroom and cry because my husband's not here and is thousands of miles away somewhere in the Middle East. I would really be the one to calm her down and be like, he still loves you, he's still coming back. Like, of course, no one's giving this to me in return. And this is like a 5, 6-year-old telling a 38-year-old woman. And so I think that really saved me a lot growing up. I've always been able to read people very, very well. And for me, like, I knew if it was going to be a good day or a bad day by my parents walking up to the door and opening the door. And if I needed to shape shift, if I needed to cover and hide from the grenade that was about to explode. And like, for my mom, I became like her therapist, her mediator, her butler, her maid, all in one thing. Like, I would like fold her laundry. I was like, very young, touching her undergarments and her bras at a very young age, folding her laundry, putting it away, doing it the same thing with my stepfather. The house always had to be clean and spotless. And we always had to do our chores before my mom came home from work, or else we would get yelled at and be told that we're ungrateful and lazy. And that very much that standardized attention, do as I say, don't talk back to me, don't have a voice, really prevented me from forming my own autonomy. And at my grandma's house, on my dad's side, my biological dad's side, I've always felt safe, always felt love. It was like a complete 180. It was like my mom's side is very rageful, very coercive, very controlling. My grandma was, it was very much my dad's side was, what can we do for the children? And on the my mom's side is, what can the children do for us? And if I wanted to bake a cake at 5 in the morning, my grandma, like, we would bake a cake at 5 in the morning because I always woke up at the crack of dawn for some reason as a kid. And so and we would bake a cake, and I loved baking. We would go fishing outside on the docks. And it was just a very magical time. My father would read me bedtime stories. My mom never did that to me. My mom never tucked me in. I remember something so simple as wanting her to throw the ball to me and she being too busy. And too busy in whatever world she is being, consumed in. And I think, like, Facebook and social media really exacerbated that because, parents now have Facebook and would post a picture of her kid playing soccer and be like, look at me, I showed up for my kid's soccer game. I'm so proud of him. And it was really a way for her to be like, look at me, I'm a great parent, not look at my child. He's a beautiful child. I never really felt heard and seen. I felt like more like property. I remember, like, when my parents went through a really bad custody battle between my biological father and mother, I very much felt like property with, like, the child pass along. Like my father would get me on the weekends and my mom would get me during the week. And it was just very chaotic going back and forth. And it felt very different from other children because I didn't see my friends, packing a suitcase and going to go stay with their father. And really much prevented having, forming those relationships as a kid and playing with friends. And there were a lot of things that were just so chaotic. And for me, like, anytime I misbehaved or anytime I acted out, my medication would be changed. And I was on such a high dosage of stimulants and SSRI medication that, like, I couldn't physically cry if I wanted to because I was just so drugged. And no one's, like, questioning any of this. No one's seeing, physicians, unfortunately, don't get the same training as psychologists. And so, like, my doctor is, like, screening, okay, like, what genetic factors is causing David to be impulsive, to not have attention, to act out, to not be able to sleep. She's thinking I have ADHD when not really my body is being traumatized by what's going on at home. Like, my mom would be like, tell my doctor, because my doctor was lived in the neighborhood as us and was my mom's, more or less, they were friends. And so my mom would tell my doctor, David is being impulsive again. David is acting out, and my medication would be changed each and every time. And I remember, like, just feeling like my heart was going to explode, like, of having so much just, like, energy. Like, I just drank, like, a Red Bull or something. And, like, I can't sit still from all of, like, the stimulants I was on. And when, like, the stimulants, like, cleared your body, you would have that deep withdrawal symptoms. Because, like, throughout the day, like, the stimulant decreases and decreases, and your body is like, where is this high that I was getting from the stimulant? And I face, a lot of medical abuse. My mom very much try to get me diagnosed with autism, and she succeeded. I got evaluated probably at least four different times by physicians until my mom found a doctor that gave her the diagnosis that she wanted. And I just felt really minimized as a person, being like, this kid has autism. And I was in ninth grade at this time, and the testing I had to do was so premature that like I had to like play with Barbie dolls, and I had to like read a story like five sentences out of like a kid's storybook, and like reset it to my grandmother in the living room. And like she knew I was being trafficked. She knew I was being, and she didn't do anything. And this is a psychiatrist. And yeah.
Okay. She wanted you to be diagnosed with autism.
Yes.
She was having you from doctor to doctor until she got the diagnosis she wanted you to have.
Yes.
You put on medication.
Yes.
This doctor, this psychiatrist, was the one that was responsible for trafficking you.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, she was aware of the sex trafficking, but she didn't report it. She didn't do anything about it. I think a lot of people knew that I was being trafficked, and they didn't do anything about it.
I'm sorry, I need some clarification.
Yeah.
When does this trafficking start exactly? Because I almost heard it as it was while you were being sent from physician to physician, that but it did it is so it started before,
Yeah,
or
well, sorry, there's just so many different layers to my story.
yeah, it's okay.
It's so like I guess let me go back. So it was really a perfect storm to why I was sex trafficked. Not feeling loved, the social isolation I grew up at home. When I was 9, my biological father, he gets arrested. And I'm told, I remember it clear as day. My mom calls me, my sister down, and tells us, your father was arrested because he wanted to hire a hitman to kill you and your father. And I was 9. And for like a 9-year-old to be hearing that your father wants you dead, I was like, I don't know how that's age appropriate, let alone okay to tell a child. There's so many things to that. And I say that because that is when really the social isolation started happening, where like I s stopped seeing my grandmother on my dad's side. It took me over 10 years to see my grandma and my cousins on my dad's side. And unfortunately, my grandfather passed away from Parkinson's. And so I didn't get to see him again before, the age when I was in third grade. And
May I ask a question?
yeah.
Do you know if this is it true that he was arrested because he was hiring someone to unalive you, or was it a narrative? Was it a story your mother made up to, I mean,
Yeah.
I'm just thinking the type of personality
Yeah.
she was.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. My father was arrested. It was never to kill me or my sister. It was some his best friend set him up. He was a private investigator, and I'm pretty sure his best friend at the time. So my biological father married into a new family, and the marriage wasn't going well. And I believe, and this is what consensus is that like his best friend, had an interest in and my father's wife, and reported my father saying things when my father was drunk at a bar, and reported to the police. And my father never went to prison. He went to jail, but like he was never convicted of anything. He was never like it was investigated, and it was all, found out to be he say, she said type of stuff. But like the narrative I was fed was completely different. And I remember like even seeing, going into, restaurants, seeing my face and my sister's face on magazines. So like everyone knows about this in my community. And like my psychological safety was just like shattered. And I would started developing major depressive disorder where I would like cry random times of the day. My teachers would have to calm me down. My sport coaches would have to, take me to the side and really talk to me. And like all of this is happening, and like no one's ever asking what's happening to the kids. No one's ever asking like, are the kids okay? And I think my mom was very much a master manipulator and was very much able to play the chess game very well. And that was what it was like growing up. It was being very strategic interacting with my mom. And so that happens. Now I'm being like, chronically neglected. I remember going to bed most nights, like yearning for love, crying because I felt so empty inside and would be listening to like the Delilah Show, which is a radio show here on the East Coast of the United States, and just hearing love stories and being like, what do they have that I don't? Like, why doesn't my mom love me? And I remember like, reading the Bible, trying to find, praying to God, like, please take this away. Like, it was so painful, the loneliness. Nothing changed. And I very much, I think, most of my life grew up, struggled with dissociation. And that's something I struggle with now. I have dissociative, we call it depersonalization, derealization disorder. And I would very much dissociate into like a third world of like a video game, or really to just be in a place where I felt safe. That was really the only way I could feel safe in all the chaos that was be I was being consumed in. And I remember like so like the next thing that happened was I started puberty again. So I started puberty when I was 7. So this is even before like I was just told my father was trying to unalive me. This was 2 years prior. I started puberty when I was 7. Was never put on hormone blockers, was never giving any, I had to teach myself how to be a man. My parents didn't do that. And so that happened. I am, when I'm 11, my mom tells me I need to go on a diet and that I need to lose weight, that I'm too overweight, I'm too husky. And I'm put on MyFitnessPal, which is tracks all of your caloric intake, it tracks your fitness routine. And I very much developed anorexia nervosa with bulimia. And she would desecrate my body, telling me, your thighs are too big, you have thunder thighs, or your head looks like the thumb from Spy Kids, or your voice sounds like Squidward, or you look like Eeyore from the TV show with you, being so depressed, walking around with your blanket, and like every part of my body, everything about me was just, even like my laugh was made fun of. And so even now when I laugh, I sometimes see my mom's disdain, and it can be hard to really, and then I kind of just like the laugh goes away.
I'm
That's all
so
happening.
sorry. I'm so
That's yeah,
sorry.
that's all happening. way, then is when 13 is really when it all began. Maybe like 12 is when I start being groomed by online predators. And I was looking for love in all the wrong places, didn't know what love was. And I think the narrative that a lot of people are told is that like children are just attention seekers. You know, it's a bad child. We don't ever stop to look at the parent's behavior. We look at, oh, that's a bad child. I'm like, the child is responding to the environment that is being brought up in. And like the primal need for children is safety and attachment. If they do not get that, they will look for it in other things. Like that's what their body is designed to do. And I think a lot of toxic parents treat their children like adults without giving them the skills of how to be one. And so I watched this rated R movie with my parents. There's some sex scene in it. I'm like, well, what's a sex scene? You know, as any 12-year-old curious boy who is traumatized and is on start puberty like 5 years ago. I look up sex, what's the sex scene? All these pornography things come up. And I'm like, well, what's this? And I've never seen what this is. And so I look at it and I am now in like heavily watching porn. And something about it, my brain just felt like my body was experiencing emotions that was not mature enough to deal with. And I was really trying, I guess, a way to numb of everything how I felt and feel less alone. And that eventually started turning into talking to online adult websites. And so I would start to talk to people on adult websites. I'm also gay, and you know, no one my age is openly coming out saying, hey, I'm gay. And so feeling very alienated in that sense as well. And really looking for a community, because I was always told that, you know, you're gay, you're gonna die. And looking for someone to tell me, you know, it's okay to love who you are, to be who you are. And really, I think of all of anything, I was really looking for a friend. I really did not have a lot of friends growing up. And the friends that I did have were so one-sided in the sense that I had to really be the one to keep the relationship going of, you know, hey, do you want to hang out? Hey, do you want to hang out and be the one calling, be the one making plans? Because no one would ever, if I didn't do that, I really would be alone because no one really reciprocated and did that for me. And so I was really looking for a friend in all of this. And these older men would groom me. They can see I'm very young. They asked me to send, you know, sexually explicit pictures to them. And my mind, I didn't think anything of it. I learned that the more sexually explicit the picture was, the more attention I got. And so I was sending them very pornographic pictures of myself to these older adults. And you know, my mom and parents are seeing all of this. Like they didn't do anything to help me. They told my therapist, they told my doctors, knew everyone knew about this. No one did anything to help me or protect me. And I think that's a lot of the problems that we, like, you know, if I was a 12-year-old girl doing this and an older, a 39-year-old is asking me to send pictures of myself, everyone's gonna be like, that's not okay. Like what? But if a boy is doing it, oh, then he must like it. Like he must, what is the boy doing it? And again, I don't see how gender changes consent. And I was being coerced of all of this. My innocence and my pain was being used against me and weaponized by people who were just trying to feel a certain way. And it turns into now, I'm 13. I met this guy online. He really starts pouring it heavy for me, telling me, I love you. I want to be with you. All these things that felt so nice. I felt so special and so seen as a kid. And, telling me my body looked good, which it was nice to hear because I was being told from my family, it wasn't. And so they were giving me everything a parent should be giving me. And one night, my they pick me up. This guy, convinces me to leave my house. He picks me up at one night, takes me back to his house. We get to his house, and I'm just like shaking at this point. And in my mind, I was like, oh, we're just gonna, have a conversation. We're just gonna talk, like I think the idea of sex came up in the back of my mind, but I was like, he wouldn't do that. He's an adult. And also, I think for me, I very much gained the schema that like sex is love. And so even if he did do that, maybe I might be loved. So there's like a lot of cognitive dissonance going on in my brain as a 13-year-old. And so he puts his hand on my thigh, and I just start shaking, and I'm like, what is happening? What is going on? He takes me to his house. We talk for a few minutes, and then he starts kissing me, and he takes my clothes off, and he takes me to his bedroom where he proceeds to assault me. And it felt like time stopped for a second. And I remember how painful everything felt. And like I, go to, he finishes whatever he's doing, and he takes me back home, and I'm like crying, trying, to shower to feel better about myself. And I eventually get the courage to tell him how bad I felt. And he normalizes it for me. He was like, well, it's supposed to feel awkward, the first time you have sex. It's supposed to. And I was like, well, I guess that kind of makes sense. It is the first time I ever had sex. And I'm trying to rationalize this as a 13-year-old kid. And so a part of me, I think, happens for a lot of boys, and I will say a part of me did enjoy it. A part of me, I felt special in that moment. And I think a lot of times the scary part about CSA is that many people enjoy it, and then they don't know it's abuse. They don't have the language. Their frontal cortex isn't developed. They just know that they're someone is shining a light on them, which they've been craving to all of their life. And they eventually get older as an adult, and they're like, oh my gosh, I was abused. And that realization comes with a tsunami of grief to finally realize, what someone did to you, and you didn't even know it.
How you were deceived
Yes.
and exploited.
Yes.
Essentially, it was your vulnerability and your ignorance and your innocence that was taken advantage of.
Yeah. And this continued for 5 years. And so I would have, now I'm like having sex with him, every most weekends, at least 3 times a week. And the sex was like would last hours. It would last 2 to sometimes 4 hours. And so this is long sessions of rape. And eventually, he started asking me, his friends started joining. And I was never trafficked in the sense that I got money. I think a lot of our definitions of trafficking needs to be updated. The thing I got was I was a good enough person, and I was validated as a human being. That's how I was trafficked, and someone picked me up and transported me to a different location to have sex with me. And most of the time I didn't know where I was. I had no way of like calling the police if I wanted to, because my phone would be left back at home. The thing is, I was more afraid of my parents finding out than my own actual safety, because that's how bad the abuse was at home. And at times, like, the neglect was so painful that in a way, the trafficking made it more bearable at home. Like, that's how bad the neglect was.
Yeah, that's
And
very telling. That's very, very telling about how you felt in the home that was supposed to be your safe space, safe haven. That's terrifying.
I need some water. Give me one second.
Yes, okay.
And so, yeah, I'm being sexually exploited. My parents knew I was being trafficked. I mean, like, for them to not know as an adult would be so ignorant. They knew I was sending pictures to older people. They knew the text messages I was sending. They would see search engines of motels on my phone. And so for them not to know, or for an adult not to know that I was being trafficked, I think would be very hard for an adult not to pick up. And like, they were going to send me to an all boys military school because they were more afraid of losing their jobs than they were about me being murdered or kidnapped, or God forbid, you know, something. I like the whole, just like, they all were so focused on themselves. That's all I
Yeah.
cared about. Like, my mom was a teacher and my stepfather was in the military. And again, like, we're this image American family. Like, no one's ever going to question that. And so it was very much my word against two adults that were respected in the community. And of course, like, your parents are going to talk to your doctors before you're going to talk to them. And like, my doctors, they knew I was being sexually active at a very young age. Like, no one questioned anything. And, you know, like, I really look at the adults. I'm just like, I was failed on every single level because there were so many barriers to protect me and no one did anything. Even like in the United States, I don't know about other countries, but like, if a physician hears or gets suspicious of any sexual activity with a child, they have to report it. It's mandated.
Yeah, it's the same here in Denmark. I think it's like that in most countries. I hope it's like that in most countries.
And no one reported anything.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, I was the one being told I'm the monster, that I'm this villain, that you're going to get arrested for child pornography or for being a prostitute, or you're going to break the family image and it's all going to be because of you. And looking back at it now, how can you say that to a child? Like, you're going to break the family for being coercively controlled by an adult makes no sense to me. And I remember one time, many times, like, again, like, I had no way of telling anyone that I was being trafficked. Like, I didn't have the language for it until I was much older. And I didn't even know what it was, to be honest with you, as a 13-year-old. But most of the time, like, I didn't have a phone on me. I had no way of communicating to the police. And so, I would be at these people's homes, no way of knowing where I was, not knowing how to get back if something were to happen, to call 911. I was so dependent on these people to take me back home. I remember one instance where I am leaving my grandmother's house. And I'm being picked up by an Uber. I'm 14 at this time. I'm in pajamas and have an iPad with, that looks like a kid's iPad with the cover and hat on it. And no one asked, like the driver, I think he was suspicious a little bit. He was like, "Hey, buddy, like, where are you going?" And I was very good at also making sure everyone thought I was okay, because you don't want to get your abusers in trouble, because if they got in trouble, then you would get even more abused. And so I'd be like, "Oh, I'm just going, to my friends, to hang out and whatnot." And he was like, "Oh, okay." And I remember he just, chatted to me like, I was an adult, and like we were having a casual conversation. He drops me off in Richmond, Virginia, and which is known for trafficking. And I at this person's house, at this person's apartment, and my iPad has no service. There's no way for me to tell him, "Hey, I'm here, I'm at your place." I'm 14-year-old in a major city, not knowing where I am. I'm not freaking out. I'm like panicking how I'm gonna get back home. I'm like pressing every directory button on the door for someone to come down to help me. I'm like telling random people on the street that are passing by, like, "You take me home. Like, I don't know where I am." And no one, this dude was like, "Sorry, like, my car is out of gas." And I was like, "Okay." And I have no way of getting home. I'm at least 30 minutes away from my grandmother's house, like a 30-minute drive. I know that would probably be like at least 4 hours of walking back home. Again, I have no way directions of getting back home. I am 14-year-old in a city with no idea about anything, and it's like 1 o'clock in the morning at winter. And that sense of just like powerlessness. And the man finally comes around, and this is like, "Hey, buddy," acting like we're best buds. And he eventually takes me back to his house, and he assaults me as well. And he gets me an Uber to go back to my grandma's house. And that all this is just so normalized to me at this point, where like I am not thinking much any of it. Again, I was more concerned about my parents lashing out at me than I was of actually my own safety. And like, again, like that's just how bad everything was. And this lasted until I was like 18 years old. And I very much formed the connection that the only way I was going to receive love is through sex. And it very much carried into my adulthood. I was hypersexually active, not really knowing why, a feeling like, I have to obey to other people, even though I don't want to have sex with them. And going along with it anyway. And there were times where, I was scared. Like, I didn't want to have sex with these older men, at all. And I feel like I couldn't say no, because if I said no, what were they gonna do? Like, were they going to like cause bodily harm to me? Were they going to kill me? Like, I don't know what's going to happen. So like, and I was always told you don't say no to your adults. And so I told myself it would be over a lot faster if I let them have it. And I would, dissociate into a third world I created for myself. And like my parents would find out, and they would ground me for months, sometimes years at a time. And which would even further the sexual abuse, because now it just furthered the social isolation of like, this is like literally the only form of connection I'm getting is through being trafficked. I remember literally having a crown maker, a puzzle, and the TV to entertain me as a kid. Like, n I had nothing. And like, yeah, it was a very difficult time. Like, I was very highly suicidal. And I attempted, suicide when I was in ninth grade, soon after I was first assaulted. And I get back, and my parents are even saying, like, you're just doing this for attention, are you? Like, I can't believe you just try to commit suicide. Like, you're such a rotten child. I'm like, who in what universe does it make sense for someone to unalive themselves to gain attention? It makes no sense whatsoever.
I'm just baffled by the lack of empathy. But yeah, I mean, it sounds like they had certain types of personality that cannot feel empathy.
I mean, in order to treat someone, another human, especially your own child, in a way,
Yeah.
really requires a lack of empathy and a
Yeah.
lack of remorse. And
Yeah.
like I always felt something, again, something's wrong with me. But this is my fault, because as children, we internalize everything because we need our parents to survive. We need our
Yeah.
caregivers to survive. And if our caregivers are dangerous, then we're actually really in danger. And so it's like, I'm going to blame myself for everything my parents do to stay safe.
Yeah.
And like, I, yeah, but my whole childhood was just really destroyed. I was obliterated as a child. I never gotten a child. Like, for me, it's really hard to really connect to people my age, because I've had to grow up significantly faster than my peers, and I have a lot more lived experience than my peers. And so there's like that sense of loneliness. And then like, I connect with people a lot older than I do, but I can't really fully connect to them because I'm not their age, and I haven't been through what they've been through. And so like, you feel like this oddball of a
Yeah.
person.
It's the same with me. That most of my friends are, I mean, one of my closest friends is like 52 and yeah, in the late 40s. And yeah, because it's exactly what you said. I just resonate with that. Yeah.
And like, for me, it's really important that I think male survivors of sexual abuse feel heard. And I think a lot of times, people, sexual assault survivors, even children, but like especially children, because their brains aren't fully developed, they, for men, and sometimes, for women, like, they get an erection, they have an orgasm, and they think that they must enjoy it, that they must have liked it. And I say to that, it's a stimulus in the environment. Like, that doesn't mean you didn't enjoy, that doesn't mean you enjoyed it. It's like if a doctor were to take, a mallet and to hit your knee to see if your knee would pop up, and your knee pops up, like you didn't enjoy it. It's the same thing. It's a reaction to a stimuli in the environment. And a lot of men blame themselves. They get really confused because they think, well, I got an erection, like I must have liked it. And they feel so much shame carrying it around. And I for it will take on average 20 years for a male to disclose about sexual abuse and 30 years to really go into detail about it. And 70% of male survivors will never share their experience, and they will pass it to their children because trauma lives in our bodies. And there's a lot of abuse out there for young boys. And I think, unfortunately, boys become perfect victims to perpetrators because they know that no one's going to believe us because we're boys. And two, they know we're not going to tell because of the stigma attached to it. And that's something that a psychologist who interviewed, a clergy member from the church, found that to be true. The clergy member was like, I never targeted boys because I was gay. It was because I knew I could get away with it. And I think the statistic we have right now is one in six boys will be sexually abused. There's some research coming out of the CDC saying it's one in three. And I definitely believe it's a lot more prevalent than one in six because there's so many boys who are targeted because they're not going to tell. Even like with the Boy Scouts Honor that came out, the Boy Scouts, it was found that there was over 82,000 reports of sexual abuse from the Boy Scouts from the 80s to the 2010s. And that's just, people report because not everyone's, there's a lot more than that. And a part of it has to do with, the way we first talked about is like with the indoctrination of young children. We tell boys that, to be strong, to be the masculine one, that men aren't supposed to be the receivers of sex. They're supposed to be the initiators, well, most of the time. And when a man gets sexually assaulted, it like plays with their masculinity that they have formed, that we design for our boys to be all of these things, to be the star athlete, to be the entrepreneur, to, be the straight A student, to be the football player. And when we don't measure up to all of these things, we think we are a failure. And there's just so much pressure. And like to even like to look a certain way, of to be macho and have the biceps and the muscles. And when men do disclose about it, like what's them for there to go to? Like, we don't have all of these resources for our women, but like what do we have for our men? Like, I can't think of a single shelter for a male to go to for sexual violence. And I feel like it's just unheard of. And we like create this culture of silence, and there's just such a negative view of when men do disclose that somehow they're dangerous, or somehow that they're going to go out and perpetrate others, and which does happen. But the only time you ever hear about male sexual abuse is when it makes major headlines in the media with, R.J. Kelly or Harvey Weinstein or Bill Cosby, people who were sexually assaulted in their children, in their childhood, and they do it to other people. That's the only time it gets makes news. And like, there's just so much that needs to be changed, even for us. Like, my friend asked me, Like, do you, when you go to the bathrooms, is there information about sex trafficking and boy stalls? And I was like, I've never seen a poster about sex trafficking in a male stall. And she was like, well, it's a really common thing in female stalls for there to be information about sex trafficking and signs to look for and numbers to call. And so, like, it really wasn't even until like the 90s that men could be, men were seen as able to be targeted for sexual assault. And so, yeah, there's just so much work to be done. And even like in the gay community, there's so much sexual abuse. Like 70% of LGBT youth will be sexually assaulted at least once by the time they're 18. And it's because of like, we're seen as defects, we're seen as less than. And so we get overlooked by caregivers. And that is, you know, what predators do their worst, because abuse thrives in silence.
I'm just sitting here thinking, if your parents, if your community knew that you were being sexually abused, trafficked by different men throughout your teens, why the fuck did no one do anything? I'm so confused. Where was the care and concern for you as a child and young man? Like, I don't understand that part. It's so confusing to me. I'm just sitting here thinking, are you not so terrified of people knowing what they are capable of doing and how their actions can have profound and lifelong consequences? I'm just sitting here thinking how difficult it is for me to trust, and I'm just thinking it must be the same for you. I have my personal reasons, but I can just imagine that someone that has lived through what you did, it must be so incredibly hard to trust anyone. Or how do you feel about trusting
It's,
people?
yeah, I'm glad you asked, because I definitely have trust issues, but like, I think for me it
Yeah.
shows up differently. I think for me, I can be overly trusting.
Okay.
I think that comes with my personality. I've always been like a very agreeable, like I very much have agreeable personality style. And so I want to see the best in people. I want to, and I think, unfortunately, that's led to my downfall a lot of times. I think for me, where it's hard to trust is dating. It's I cannot stand the talking phase, because there's so much like so much anxiety of like, does this person really like me? Am I not enough? Did I say something? If they ghost me nowadays, just so terrible to do someone. I'm like, is it me? Like, did I say something too much? Like, what could I have done better? The rumination, you know, happens. And then I'm like, how do I know that you won't leave me when I need you? Or,
Yeah.
yeah, it's, I would say that's where it really gets me. And I can be, I think, cynical of love, being like, that happens to other people, that doesn't happen to me. Or like, when, so, like, what are you trying to get from me? Like when you, when someone starts liking me.
Yeah. But that makes sense with the history you have, that you fear that this must be because you want something from me. I resonate with that. I have that myself, you know.
Yeah, there's so much, like for me, I very much see child abuse as like murder, like because you are forever changing the developmental trajectory of someone, and there are parts of that person that they will never get to develop. There are parts of that person that has forever changed, and there's no going back to the person who they was or could have been. Like
Yeah.
that person's light is dimmed, so much potential is taken away from them. And the harm done to a child by a narcissistic parent or a narcissistic person I say narcissist because it's not like, warm, cuddly, empathic people are the ones doing this. And the harm, it's unparalleled, the harm done to a child. Like for decades, that child is told that at best they're an inconvenience and their needs are seen as a burden. They're told not to have needs, and that if they do have needs, they're ungrateful. They're gaslighted their whole life, and so their reality is just totally flip-flopped. It sets them up for a lifetime long of abusive, trauma-bonded relationships where it's one-sided at best. It completely dysregulates their nervous system. And we, I don't know if you know about the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experience study, but trauma impacts every part of the body. It doesn't impact the brain, and trauma is accumulative. And trauma can have impacts of mortality. It can have impacts of chronic illnesses and eating disorders and substance abuse, even like cancer and chronic illnesses. And so, it makes me so angry when, about child abuse. I think it's such a taboo topic to talk about that people don't want to discuss it. People don't want their worldview to be diminished, or they'll be like, that's a them problem. I don't want to, get involved in it. I'm like, child abuse is anyone who knows about child abuse, it's anyone's business.
It is.
Because you are an adult, or you have the knowledge that someone else is being harmed in a way. It's even worse than what the abuse is doing, because you know that what that person is going through is bad and you are not doing anything about it.
But child abuse is also a societal problem. It's a economical problem because just look at psychiatry. I'm a nurse. I was a nurse in psychiatry. I have been a patient in psychiatry. Are you aware the majority of them, they have childhood trauma? They
I'm sorry,
have
which
childhood trauma.
psych nurses?
They're going, no, psychiatry. The patients in psychiatry, the majority of them have childhood trauma. So when they are hospitalized, it costs. When they get on medication, it costs. It's expensive when people are abused because they're going to need hospitalization. They're going to need help. Many of them are not able to take an education. They're not able to work. They're not, I mean, child abuse is anyone who says that's not my business, it is your business. It's society's business. It's everyone's business. And every adult has an obligation. If you know that a child is being harmed, that's how it is in Denmark, you have to go to the authorities and say, I'm aware of, oh, I heard this is going on, so the authorities can look into it. You not just ignore it, but many people do. That was the same in my case,
And
and
that's the
it's
thing, like, yeah,
horrific.
it's horrific. And like you said, I'm glad you mentioned that too, because like people act that like once someone's been abused that and they get out of it, that they're automatically going to be better. That and they're like, they're like, this is a new chapter, why can't you just like that's in the past? Why can't you let them go? Like, and it's like, I'm like, think of it as this. Like if someone were to come out of a burning building, like they wouldn't immediately be back to normal. Like they would have burn marks they would have to attend to, maybe get skin grafts or rehabilitation. Like it's the same thing with abuse survivors of mental abuse. It's the same thing. And the thing is, like, we treat physical abuse, oh, that's an actual thing, that's an actual problem. But mental abuse, this psychological abuse is just as devastating, and it can impact your physical health. And many times, like, our society is not built for healing, because like when you are abused, your HPA axis is moderately on all the time, which is your threat response system. And so the person's never really relaxing. And we've seen the brain of a PTSD person compared to non-PTSD, and their body is using significantly more glucose and oxygen uptake than someone who's not. And so your body
Yeah.
is literally working twice as hard than someone who did not have PTSD. And that's why, like, halfway through the day, that person is so tired. They have chronic fatigue. They have fibromyalgia, and they can't work a 40-hour work week. They can't work a 60-hour work week because they're trying to recover the shattered pieces that were left by their parents.
Yeah.
And it's not something that someone can, like, just get over. Like, childhood is the foundation to someone's house for the rest of their life.
Yeah,
Like,
absolutely.
and I completely agree with you. Like, there's so much victim blaming. There's so much, no one's a perfect parent, or your parent did the best for you. I was like, that, no.
No. Yeah, I've heard the same. The people who traffic me and where I lived under slave-like condition, oh, you should be grateful because of what you came from. I'm not going to be grateful for shit. Are you out of your mind?
Yeah.
These people completely destroyed my life. I'm not grateful.
My favorite is, it could have been worse.
Ah.
I was like, what? When you tell a trauma survivor it could have been worse, I'm like, it could have been a hell of a lot better. That's for sure.
Exactly.
I'm like, what do you mean it could have been worse?
Yeah.
It's so much minimization. When someone says, like, starts with "at least," I'm like, okay, here comes the minimization train, because there's nothing
Yeah.
and good at the end of it.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, like, when you abuse a child, like, it's not, you're impacting a whole community, because that person
Yeah.
is going to interact with other people, and those people are going to interact with other people. And
Yeah.
so it's a community issue.
Yeah, it is.
And for 100%. And a lot of people who have trauma, like, they need so much resources to get through the day. And a lot of these things are so expensive. Not everyone can afford therapy, because therapy is very much designed for educated white people.
Yeah.
And, like, it's such a problem.
Yeah.
And even, like, people don't have time for therapy because of hustle culture.
Yeah.
And so you have to work 60 hours a week to, make ends meet. Like, the last thing you're going to think about is, hey, I need to treat my problems, because you're trying to put dinner on the table for you and maybe your children.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, there's.
It's just so, it's so problematic, and I really do believe that by us survivors sharing our stories through autobiographies, podcast interviews, public speaking, I don't care, just getting out there and telling our stories, I really believe that that is the path to support other survivors, to spread awareness, and eventually, I hope that more and more like schools, institutions, healthcare system will become more aware of this is a really massive issue. We need to do something. Do you know who Jeremy Indica is?
I feel like the name's familiar, but I haven't.
Yeah, he was sexually abused as a child by a family friend, and now he's on a mission. He's made the organization, it's an NGO, it's called Something to Say, where he has this Instagram page where people, I'm on that page too, they send in their picture, and then this is how they break the silence. They share their stories of how they survived child sexual abuse, and he travels around. So he just started having online like speaking events where he teaches about the statistics of child sexual abuse, men, boys and girls, and he's on a mission to spread awareness. And I admire his work. It does not look easy at all. And he does experience a lot of pushback. But I am just convinced that eventually, if more and more of us step forth and do this, something will change.
Yeah.
Because this is a societal problem. It is.
I think when survivors come together is when the greatest change can happen because your voices become magnified. It's not just one person against, an army of people. Now it's multiple people. And that's what I want. Like, I want this to be in the media. Like, I'm taking part in an anti-grooming campaign and I'm working on getting a documentary done about my upbringing, just like for people to be aware that men can be abused too, and for people to be educated what grooming is and what abuse isn't always, bruises and, lacerations. There's a lot of signs of a child can shows that they're being abused, like personality changes, or they look significantly, they're withdrawn, they're depressed, they're acting differently. And so, there's just so much to be done.
There
And
is.
I think there's definitely the toxic positivity culture that I think starting to get squashed, but this makes you stronger or whatnot. This like the trauma doesn't make you stronger. Healing is what makes you stronger. The trauma dysregulates your nervous system, makes it harder to trust people, and forever changes your psychological safety. That doesn't make someone stronger.
No, it's complete bullshit. And it's, I think, I believe sayings like that is just, it's rooted in ignorance.
100%.
And I honestly, and I'm gonna say it, it's, privileged people say that. I know privilege is many things. But someone who really has walked through the fire, someone who has experienced what it's like to be dehumanized, not have privileges, they would never say shit like that. And that's why I'm convinced it's rooted in ignorance and privilege, is because you have not struggled to the extent that you know what this is about. So I'm actually going to need you to not talk right now because ignorance can do a lot of harm, and I'm honestly just like, humble yourself, please. You
Yes,
know?
100%. Go read a book.
Exactly. I like to say that as it is. Read a book, and if you're incapable of that, shut up. It's quite simple.
Listen to an autobiography. It's much easier.
Yes, exactly. No, honestly, you want expert knowledge? Talk to a survivor.
Yeah,
You want to speak to an
100%.
expert? Speak to a survivor. Speak to someone who has walked through the fire and risen against all odds. That's the expert. Lived experiences are expert knowledge, in my opinion.
100%. There's kids, we learn everything that is taught, to not engage with people, to be discernment, I think survivors are the most flexible people. I call it fucked up resilience. It's like we know how to shape shift to get to the next point and to carry the people around us to, like when a disaster happens, like I'm calling my trauma survivors. I ain't calling the man down the street. I'm calling my trauma survivors and being like, hey, we need to get the hell out of Dodge. Like, there's a hurricane coming for us.
No, really, we know how to survive through the shit and bounce back because we didn't have a choice. So if anyone knows, it's us. You know, that's how I feel.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, I'm so glad we met. I think there is so much work to be done on both angles, on, both genders, and really in all communities. I think it's not just, I think it's a societal issue of child abuse.
Yeah, it is.
Not unfortunately, not everyone survives it. And for me, I don't know if you ever watched the Jeffrey Dahmer thing, the movie, the documentary on Jeffrey Dahmer, but like
Oh,
seeing
maybe.
that 13-year-old boy who was, you know, murdered, and sexually abused, I was like, I was 13. And when it happened to me, there's just so, like, again, like, there's so much light that's stolen from people. So much evil. And it's time for the adults to start being an adult and for the children to be the children and not the other way around.
I completely agree with you, and I know that the suicide rates, they are extremely high for survivors of child sexual abuse, you know, childhood trauma, but especially childhood sexual abuse. And no wonder, because it messes with you on such a profound level. I was First time I experienced it, I was 4 years old, and it was just throughout my entire childhood. And I actually can't articulate on how messed up it makes you, because it's on such a profound level. It can be quite difficult to explain. But I think the most debilitating and heart-wrenching thing of it all is this shame and self-blame, because it was not our fault. And that's why I began speaking up, and that's why I wanted to be a part of the Something to Say, you know, Jeremy Indica's community, because my message to survivors of CSA was the shame and blame we feel are not ours to carry, and you got to send that shit back to sender. I don't care if you do it through a podcast interview, if you write a letter, if you go out to the ocean and you scream it out, if you just scream, fuck you, and you, and you for abusing me. I don't care how you do it. If you call them and say, but you just got to know that was not your fault, and you can send that shit back where it belongs. And that is also something I have to repeat again and again to myself. It was not my fault.
It's not, and there's so much shame, and there's like, I won't get into it too much, but you know, I think a lot of people forget we are attachment-seeking creatures, and like there is a science behind why we shame ourselves because, like, you know, if we do something bad happens to us, we might lose connection with the people around us, like with the tribe we need. And so if something bad happens to us on a logical level, we know that's not our fault, but our emotional brain is not saying that to us. It's something bad happened to me. It must be my fault. Let me not lose connection with the people around me. So I'm going to shame myself. And that's why there's so much shame. And then there's the external shame that, you know, we get from the society, which just magnifies it. It's so much. And I know for me, I guess the last thing I'll share about my story, and I know we're wrapping up here soon, but like, when I started sharing my story, my parents hired a PI, tracked me down, and threatened to sue me for defamation for telling my story. And I was like, the amount of betrayal in that letter, I was like, in what world does that make sense? And I had to navigate the legal system, getting an attorney to, and they eventually backed down. But like, to me, it was a clear message that how dare you break the family image, that the family image is more important than our own child. And it was like my story was, it was actually that bad. Like it was like a message. Now I have physical proof. My parents literally give two hoots about me. And yeah, again, like, and that's why people, I think, also don't speak out, because the intimidation that abusers can have, often abusers are in status of power, are they adored by the community, are they the the pastor down the street, and
Yeah.
it's your word against, an adored public figure.
Yeah. It is. And the worst part is they know. And they do what they do because they know that they can get away with it. And that's just it's I actually don't have a word for it. It's just it breaks my heart and it makes me really, really angry. David, so if there are any young men or just men at any age that are listening right now, is there something you would like to pay forward to them?
I would say, again, like the conversation we had, to not shame yourself, because nothing ever good will come from shaming yourself. That this wasn't, it really wasn't your fault. And sometimes you really have to convince yourself to believe it was not your fault. And, it, and I say that it's not going to make the pain, any worse. I mean, any better. If anything, it might make it hurt more to realize, but like there is light at the end of the tunnel, that getting over trauma is not like getting over the flu. There's no pill you can take to numb it. There's no magical dance, kale, 5-step program you can do to make it get better. It is literally sitting with your pain and getting comfortable in the discomfort and getting in tune with your nervous system. And there's nothing weak about being able to express and communicate yourself. There's it's not, if anything, that comes from a place of strength, because you are aware of yourself to know that you need help, and not everyone has the ability to do that.
Thank you so much. That was so beautiful. And a huge thanks for being here. I am in awe of you. And I just want to, I know I said it several times, I just want to say I'm so sorry what you lived through. And I am so deeply touched by just your beauty. And when I say that, I'm not only talking about the physical, I'm actually more talking about the fact that you are sitting here with your beautiful smile and you have this mission and you want to make a difference and you're doing it. And I just want to say thank you for being a light in this world. We need people like you, we need men like you, and I know that you're going to help so many. And if you ever go into public speaking or anything, I have tears in my eyes. I want to be there. I want to be in the audience and I want to be there so you can feel that you have a sister with you in spirit. I'm cheering on you. I'm rooting for you. I'm going to follow you on Instagram if I don't already do that. And I just see a rising star and I can't wait to see where life takes you. And I just want to thank you. It's such an honor that you want to be on my podcast, and it's such an honor to be in your presence. It's just thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate all of that. And yes, if I ever get this TED Talk speaker, I'll definitely let you know for
Please
sure.
invite me. I want to
Yes.
come so I can be there, cheer on you, and yeah, see you shine, and yeah.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And yes, I think the work you're doing is truly commendable. Giving the platform to other survivors of trauma is, the greatest gift you can give to someone, because, freeing, breaking the silence, you're freeing that shame that you've carried around for so long, and you're saying, you're taking a step forward into creating a better life for yourself. And you're not saying, you're saying, I am not going to carry this around with me anymore. And that's when you share your story, other people are going to be want to share their story, and then people are going to want to share their story, and it just snowballs. And then, as soon as you know, you have 1,000 voices, speaking loudly. And I think that's what it's really going to need to take, is going to need to take 1,000 voices of strong survivors coming together and saying, we demand change, and we demand change now, not later. We demand it now. And we want a better future for our children that are growing up.
I absolutely agree with you, and that was the whole point of this podcast. That's the foundation. I wanted to give others what no one granted me, but I wish they had. And that was a space where I could be seen and heard. And I do believe that this podcast, among what you're doing, what Jeremy is doing, is going to have a ripple effect. So we just got to keep going. And I believe that we need to support each other, because this journey is not
100%.
always easy.
Yes, and
So,
never, like, I could not have gone, a lot of the things I have done, I've done on my own, but a lot of the hard work, a lot of the hard healing, I could not have done alone. And I tell people, like, you do not have to go through this alone. There's people out there who want to support you, who want to see the best in you, and you just have to be willing to let them in, which I know is like the most scariest thing in the world when you when everyone around you has let you down. So
That's why survivor community is so important.
100%, 100%.
David,
Yes.
thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Likewise. That was it for today. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please remember to rate Alchemical Voices and follow the community on Instagram. Until next time.